London, that great large place. Nobody, not even Mr. Bumble, could ever find him there. He had often heard the old men in the workhouse, too, say that no lad of spirit need want in London, and that there were ways of living in that vast city which those who had been bred up in country parts had no idea of. It was the very place for a homeless boy who must die in the streets unless someone helped him. As these things passed through his thoughts, he jumped upon his feet and again walked forward. He had diminished the distance between himself and London by full 4 miles more before he recollected how much he must undergo ere he could hope to reach his place of destination. As this consideration forced itself upon him, he slackened his pace a little and meditated upon his means of getting there. He had a crust of bread, a coarse shirt, and 2 pairs of stockings in his bundle. He had a penny, too, a gift of sourberries after some funeral in which he had acquitted himself more than ordinarily well, in his pocket. A clean shirt, thought Oliver, is a very comfortable thing, and so are 2 pairs of darned stockings, and so is a penny, but they are small helps to a 65 miles walk in winter time. But Oliver's thoughts, like those of most other people, although they were extremely ready and active to point out his difficulties, were wholly at a loss to suggest any feasible mode of surmounting them. So, after a good deal of thinking to no particular purpose, he changed his little bundle over to the other shoulder and trudged on. Oliver walked 20 miles that day, and all that time tasted nothing but the crust of dry bread and a few draughts of water which he begged at the cottage doors by the roadside. When the night came, he turned into a meadow, and, creeping close under a hayrick, determined to lie there till morning. He felt frightened at first, for the wind moaned dismally over the empty fields, and he was cold and hungry, and more alone than he had ever felt before. Being very tired with his walk, however, he soon fell asleep and forgot his troubles. He felt cold and stiff when he got up next morning, and so hungry that he was obliged to exchange the penny for a small loaf in the very first village through which he passed. He had walked no more than 12 miles when night closed in again. His feet were sore, and his legs so weak that they trembled beneath him. Another night passed in the bleak, damp air made him worse. When he set forward on his journey next morning, he could hardly crawl along. He waited at the bottom of a steep hill till a stagecoach came up, and then begged of the outside passengers. But there were very few who took any notice of him, and even those told him to wait till they got to the top of the hill, and then let them see how far he could run for a halfpenny. Poor Oliver tried to keep up with the coach a little way, but was unable to do it by reason of his fatigue and sore feet. When the outsides saw this, they put their halfpence back into their pockets again, declaring that he was an idle young dog and didn't deserve anything. And the coach rattled away, and left only a cloud of dust behind. In some villages, large painted boards were fixed up, warning all persons who begged within the district that they would be sent to jail. This frightened Oliver very much, and made him glad to get out of those villages with all possible expedition. In others, he would stand about the inn yards and look mournfully at everyone who passed, a proceeding which generally terminated in the landlady's ordering one of the postboys who were lounging about to drive that strange boy out of the place, for she was sure he'd come to steal something. If he begged at a farmer's house, 10 to 1, but they threatened to set the dog on him. And when he showed his nose in a shop, they talked about the beadle, which brought Oliver's heart into his mouth, very often the only thing he had there for many hours together. In fact, if it had not been for a good-hearted turnpike man and a benevolent old lady, Oliver's troubles would have been shortened by the very same process which had put an end to his mother's. In other words, he would most assuredly have fallen dead upon the king's highway. But the turnpike man gave him a meal of bread and cheese, and the old lady, who had a shipwrecked grandson wandering barefoot in some distant part of the earth, took pity upon the poor orphan, and gave him what little she could afford, and more, with such kind and gentle words, and such tears of sympathy and compassion, that they sank deeper into Oliver's soul than all the sufferings he had ever undergone. Early on the 7th morning, after he had left his native place, Oliver limped slowly into the little town of Barnet. The window shutters were closed. The street was empty. Not a soul had awakened to the business of the day. The sun was rising in all its splendid beauty, but the light only served to show the boy his own lonesomeness and desolation, as he sat with bleeding feet and covered with dust, upon a cold doorstep. By degrees the shutters were opened, the window blinds were drawn up, and people began passing to and fro. Some few stopped to gaze at Oliver for a moment or two, or turned round to stare at him as they hurried by, but none relieved him, or troubled themselves to inquire how he came there. He had no heart to beg, and there he sat. He had been crouching on the step for some time, wondering at the great number of public houses. Every other house in Barnet was a tavern, large or small, gazing listlessly at the coaches as they passed through, and thinking how strange it seemed that they could do with ease in a few hours what it had taken him a whole week of courage and determination beyond his years to accomplish, when he was roused by observing that a boy, who had passed him carelessly some minutes before, had returned, and was now surveying him most earnestly from the opposite side of the way. He took little heed of this at first, but the boy remained in the same attitude of close observation so long that Oliver raised his head and returned his steady look. Upon this, the boy crossed over, and walking close up to Oliver, said,
"Hallo, my covey, what's the row?"
The boy who addressed this inquiry to the young wayfarer was about his own age, but one of the queerest-looking boys that Oliver had ever seen. He was a snub-nosed, flat-browed, common-faced boy enough, and as dirty a juvenile as one would wish to see. But he had about him all the airs and manners of a man. He was short of his age, with rather bow legs and little, sharp, ugly eyes. His hat was stuck on the top of his head so lightly that it threatened to fall off every moment, and would have done so very often, if the wearer had not had a knack of every now and then giving his head a sudden twitch, which brought it back to its old place again. He wore a man's coat, which reached nearly to his heels. He had turned the cuffs back halfway up his arm to get his hands out of the sleeves, apparently with the ultimate view of thrusting them into the pockets of his corduroy trousers, for there he kept them. He was altogether as roistering and swaggering a young gentleman as ever stood 4 feet 6 or something less in his bluchers.
"Hallo, my covey, what's the row?"
said this strange young gentleman to Oliver.
"I'm very hungry and tired," replied Oliver, the tears standing in his eyes as he spoke. "I've walked a long way. I've been walking these 7 days."
"Walking for 7 days?"
said the young gentleman.
"Oh, I see. Beak's order, eh? But,"
he added, noticing Oliver's look of surprise,
"I suppose you don't know what a beak is, my flash companion."
Oliver mildly replied that he had always heard a bird's mouth described by the term in question.
"My eyes, how green!" exclaimed the young gentleman. "Why, a beak's a magistrate, and when you walk by a beak's order, it's not straight forward, but always a going up, and never a coming down again. Was you never on the mill?"
"What mill?" inquired Oliver.
"What mill? Why, the mill! The mill as takes up so little room that it'll work inside a stone jug, and always goes better when the wind's low with people than when it's high, because then they can't get workmen. But come," said the young gentleman, "you want grub, and you shall have it. I'm at a low water mark myself, only one bob and a magpie, but as far as it goes, I'll fork out and stump. Up with you on your pins, there. Now then, Morris!"
Assisting Oliver to rise, the young gentleman took him to an adjacent chandler's shop, where he purchased a sufficiency of ready-dressed ham and a half-quartern loaf, or, as he himself expressed it, a fourpenny bran, the ham being kept clean and preserved from dust by the ingenious expedient of making a hole in the loaf by pulling out a portion of the crumb and stuffing it therein. Taking the bread under his arm, the young gentleman turned into a small public house, and led the way to a tap-room in the rear of the premises. Here a pot of beer was brought in by direction of the mysterious youth, and Oliver, falling to at his new friend's bidding, made a long and hearty meal, during the progress of which the strange boy eyed him from time to time with great attention.
"Going to London?"
said the strange boy, when Oliver had at length concluded.
"Yes."
"Got any lodgings?"
"No."
"Money?"
"No." The strange boy whistled and put his arms into his pockets, as far as the big coat sleeves would let them go.
"Do you live in London?" inquired Oliver.
"Yes, I do, when I'm at home," replied the boy. "I suppose you want some place to sleep in tonight, don't you?"
"I do, indeed," answered Oliver. "I have not slept under a roof since I left the country."
"Oh, don't fret your eyelids on that score," said the young gentleman. "I've got to be in London tonight, and I know a 'spectable old gentleman as lives there what'll give you lodgings for nothink and never ask for the change. That is, if any gentleman he knows introduces you. And don't he know me? Oh, no, not in the least. By no means, certainly not."
The young gentleman smiled, as if to intimate that the latter fragments of discourse were playfully ironical, and finished the beer as he did so. This unexpected offer of shelter was too tempting to be resisted, especially as it was immediately followed up by the assurance that the old gentleman referred to would doubtless provide Oliver with a comfortable place without loss of time. This led to a more friendly and confidential dialogue, from which Oliver discovered that his friend's name was Jack Dawkins, and that he was a peculiar pet and protégé of the elderly gentleman before mentioned. Mr. Dawkins' appearance did not say a vast deal in favour of the comforts which his patron's interest obtained for those whom he took under his protection. But as he had a rather flighty and dissolute mode of conversing, and furthermore avowed that among his intimate friends he was better known by the sobriquet of the Artful Dodger, Oliver concluded that, being of a dissipated and careless turn, the moral precepts of his benefactor had hitherto been thrown away upon him. Under this impression, he secretly resolved to cultivate the good opinion of the old gentleman as quickly as possible, and, if he found the Dodger incorrigible, as he more than half suspected he should, to decline the honour of his further acquaintance. As John Dawkins objected to their entering London before nightfall, it was nearly 11 o'clock when they reached the turnpike at Islington. They crossed from the Angel into St. John's Road, struck down the small street which terminates at Sadler's Wells Theatre, through Exmouth Street and Coppice Row, down the little court by the side of the workhouse, across the classic ground which once bore the name of Hockley in the Hole, thence into Little Saffron Hill, and so into Saffron Hill the Great, along which the Dodger scudded at a rapid pace, directing Oliver to follow close at his heels. Although Oliver had enough to occupy his attention in keeping sight of his leader, he could not help bestowing a few hasty glances on either side of the way as he passed along. A dirtier or more wretched place he had never seen. The street was very narrow and muddy, and the air was impregnated with filthy odours. There were a good many small shops, but the only stock in trade appeared to be heaps of children, who even at that time of night were crawling in and out at the doors, or screaming from the inside. The sole places that seemed to prosper amid the general blight of the place were the public houses, and in them the lowest orders of Irish were wrangling with might and main. Covered ways and yards, which here and there diverged from the main street, disclosed little knots of houses, where drunken men and women were positively wallowing in filth. And from several of the doorways great ill-looking fellows were cautiously emerging, bound, to all appearance, on no very well-disposed or harmless errands. Oliver was just considering whether he hadn't better run away when they reached the bottom of the hill. His conductor, catching him by the arm, pushed open the door of a house near Field Lane, and drawing him into the passage, closed it behind them.
"Now then," cried a voice from below, in reply to a whistle from the Dodger. "Plummy and slam," was the reply.
This seemed to be some watchword or signal that all was right, for the light of a feeble candle gleamed on the wall at the remote end of the passage, and a man's face peeped out from where a balustrade of the old kitchen staircase had been broken away.
"There's two on you," said the man, thrusting the candle farther out and shading his eyes with his hand. "Who's the t'other one?"
"A new pal,"
replied Jack Dawkins, pulling Oliver forward.
"Where did he come from?"
"Greenland. Is Fagin upstairs?"
"Yes, he's a-sorting the wipes. Up with you."
The candle was drawn back, and the face disappeared. Oliver, groping his way with one hand and having the other firmly grasped by his companion, ascended with much difficulty the dark and broken stairs, which his conductor mounted with an ease and expedition that showed he was well acquainted with them. He threw open the door of a back room and drew Oliver in after him. The walls and ceiling of the room were perfectly black with age and dirt. There was a deal table before the fire, upon which were a candle stuck in a ginger beer bottle, two or three pewter pots, a loaf and butter, and a plate. In a frying pan, which was on the fire, and which was secured to the mantel shelf by a string, some sausages were cooking. And standing over them, with a toasting fork in his hand, was a very old, shrivelled Jew, whose villainous-looking and repulsive face was obscured by a quantity of matted red hair. He was dressed in a greasy flannel gown, with his throat bare, and seemed to be dividing his attention between the frying pan and a clothes horse, over which a great number of silk handkerchiefs were hanging. Several rough beds made of old sacks were huddled side by side on the floor. Seated round the table were four or five boys, none older than the Dodger, smoking long clay pipes, and drinking spirits with the air of middle-aged men. These all crowded about their associate as he whispered a few words to the Jew, and then turned round and grinned at Oliver. So did the Jew himself, toasting fork in hand.
"This is him, Fagin," said Jack Dawkins. "My friend, Oliver Twist."
The Jew grinned, and, making a low obeisance to Oliver, took him by the hand and hoped he should have the honour of his intimate acquaintance. Upon this, the young gentleman with the pipes came round him and shook both his hands very hard, especially the one in which he held his little bundle. One young gentleman was very anxious to hang up his cap for him, and another was so obliging as to put his hands in his pockets, in order that, as he was very tired, he might not have the trouble of emptying them himself when he went to bed. These civilities would probably have been extended much farther, but for a liberal exercise of the Jew's toasting fork on the heads and shoulders of the affectionate youths who offered them.
"We are very glad to see you, Oliver. Very," said the Jew. "Dodger, take off the sausages, and draw a tub near the fire for Oliver. Ah, you're staring at the pocket handkerchiefs, eh, my dear? There are a good many of them, ain't there? We've just looked them out, ready for the wash. That's all, Oliver. That's all."
The latter part of this speech was hailed by a boisterous shout from all the hopeful pupils of the merry old gentleman, in the midst of which they went to supper. Oliver ate his share, and the Jew then mixed him a glass of hot gin and water, telling him he must drink it off directly, because another gentleman wanted the tumbler. Oliver did as he was desired. Immediately afterwards, he felt himself gently lifted onto one of the sacks, and then he sank into a deep sleep. Chapter 9, containing further particulars concerning the pleasant old gentleman and his hopeful pupils. It was late next morning when Oliver awoke from a sound, long sleep. There was no other person in the room but the old Jew, who was boiling some coffee in a saucepan for breakfast, and whistling softly to himself as he stirred it round and round with an iron spoon. He would stop every now and then to listen when there was the least noise below, and when he had satisfied himself, he would go on whistling and stirring again, as before. Although Oliver had roused himself from sleep, he was not thoroughly awake. There is a drowsy state between sleeping and waking, when you dream more in 5 minutes with your eyes half open, and yourself half conscious of everything that is passing around you, than you would in 5 nights with your eyes fast closed, and your senses wrapped in perfect unconsciousness. At such times a mortal knows just enough of what his mind is doing to form some glimmering conception of its mighty powers, its bounding from earth and spurning time and space when freed from the restraint of its corporeal associate. Oliver was precisely in this condition. He saw the Jew with his half-closed eyes, heard his low whistling, and recognised the sound of the spoon grating against the saucepan's sides. And yet the self-same senses were mentally engaged at the same time in busy action with almost everybody he had ever known. When the coffee was done, The Jew drew the saucepan to the hob, standing then in an irresolute attitude for a few minutes, as if he did not well know how to employ himself. He turned round and looked at Oliver, and called him by his name. He did not answer, and was, to all appearance, asleep. After satisfying himself upon this head, the Jew stepped gently to the door, which he fastened. He then drew forth, as it seemed to Oliver, from some trap in the floor, a small box, which he placed carefully on the table. His eyes glistened as he raised the lid and looked in. Dragging an old chair to the table, he sat down and took from it a magnificent gold watch, sparkling with jewels.
"Aha!"
said the Jew, shrugging up his shoulders and distorting every feature with a hideous grin.
"Clever dogs! Clever dogs! Staunch to the last! Never told the old parson where they were! Never peached upon old Fagin! And why should they? It wouldn't have loosened the knot, or kept the drop up a minute longer. No, no, no! Fine fellows! Fine fellows!"
With these and other muttered reflections of the like nature, the Jew once more deposited the watch in its place of safety. At least half a dozen more were severally drawn forth from the same box, and surveyed with equal pleasure, besides rings, brooches, bracelets, and other articles of jewellery of such magnificent materials and costly workmanship that Oliver had no idea even of their names. Having replaced these trinkets, the Jew took out another, so small that it lay in the palm of his hand. There seemed to be some very minute inscription on it, for the Jew laid it flat upon the table, and, shading it with his hand, pored over it long and earnestly. At length he put it down, as if despairing of success, and, leaning back in his chair, muttered,
"What a fine thing capital punishment is! Dead men never repent. Dead men never bring awkward stories to light. Ah, oh, it's a fine thing for the trade. 5 of them strung up in a row, and none left to play booty or turn white-livered."
As the Jew uttered these words, his bright, dark eyes, which had been staring vacantly before him, fell on Oliver's face. The boy's eyes were fixed on his in mute curiosity, and although the recognition was only for an instant, for the briefest space of time that can possibly be conceived, it was enough to show the old man that he had been observed. He closed the lid of the box with a loud crash, and laying his hand on a bread knife which was on the table, started furiously up. He trembled very much, though, for even in his terror Oliver could see that the knife quivered in the air. End of side 2. Side 3.
"What's that?" said the Jew. "What do you watch me for? Why are you awake? What have you seen? Speak out, boy. Quick, quick for your life."
I wasn't able to sleep any longer, sir," replied Oliver meekly. "I am very sorry if I have disturbed you, sir."
"You were not awake an hour ago?"
said the Jew, scowling fiercely on the boy.
"No, no indeed," replied Oliver.
"Are you sure?"
cried the Jew, with a still fiercer look than before, and a threatening attitude.
"Upon my word, I was not, sir," replied Oliver earnestly. "I was not indeed, sir."
"Tush, tush, my dear,"
said the Jew, abruptly resuming his old manner, and playing with the knife a little before he laid it down, as if to induce the belief that he had caught it up in mere sport.
"Of course I know that, my dear. I only tried to frighten you. You're a brave boy. You're a brave boy, Oliver."
The Jew rubbed his hands with a chuckle, but glanced uneasily at the box, notwithstanding.
"Did you see any of these pretty things, my dear?"
said the Jew, laying his hand upon it after a short pause.
"Yes, sir," replied Oliver.
"Ah,"
said the Jew, turning rather pale.
They're mine, Oliver. My little property. All I have to live upon in my old age. The folks call me a miser, my dear. Only a miser. That's all."
Oliver thought the old gentleman must be a decided miser to live in such a dirty place, with so many watches. But thinking that perhaps his fondness for the Dodger and the other boys cost him a good deal of money, He only cast a deferential look at the Jew and asked if he might get up.
"Certainly, my dear, certainly," replied the old gentleman. "Stay. There's a pitcher of water in the corner by the door. Bring it here, and I'll give you a basin to wash in, my dear."
Oliver got up, walked across the room, and stooped for an instant to raise the pitcher. When he turned his head, the box was gone. He had scarcely washed himself and made everything tidy by emptying the basin out of the window, agreeably to the Jew's directions, when the Dodger returned, accompanied by a very sprightly young friend whom Oliver had seen smoking on the previous night, and who was now formally introduced to him as Charlie Bates. The four sat down to breakfast on the coffee and some hot rolls and ham which the Dodger had brought home in the crown of his hat.
"Well,"
said the Jew, glancing slyly at Oliver and addressing himself to the Dodger,
"I hope you've been at work this morning, my dears."
"Hard," replied the Dodger.
"As nails," added Charlie Bates.
"Good boys, good boys," said the Jew. "What have you got, Dodger?"
"A couple of pocketbooks," replied that young gentleman.
"Lined?"
inquired the Jew with eagerness.
"Pretty well,"
replied the Dodger, producing two pocketbooks, one green and the other red.
"Not so heavy as they might be,"
said the Jew, after looking at the insides carefully,
"but very neat and nicely made. Ingenious workman, ain't he, Oliver?"
"Very, indeed, sir," said Oliver.
At which Mr. Charles Bates laughed uproariously, very much to the amazement of Oliver, who saw nothing to laugh at in anything that had passed.
"And what have you got, my dear?"
said Fagin to Charlie Bates.
"Wipes,"
replied Master Bates, at the same time producing four pocket handkerchiefs.
"Well,"
said the Jew, inspecting them closely,
"they're very good ones, very. You haven't marked them well, though, Charlie. So the marks shall be picked out with a needle, and we'll teach Oliver how to do it. Shall us, Oliver, eh?"
"If you please, sir," said Oliver.
"You'd like to be able to make pocket handkerchiefs as easy as Charlie Bates, wouldn't you, my dear?"
said the Jew.
"Very much, indeed, if you'll teach me, sir," replied Oliver.
Master Bates saw something so exquisitely ludicrous in this reply that he burst into another laugh, which laugh, meeting the coffee he was drinking and carrying it down some wrong channel, very nearly terminated in his premature suffocation.
"He is so jolly green,"
said Charlie when he recovered, as an apology to the company for his unpolite behaviour. The Dodger said nothing, but he smoothed Oliver's hair over his eyes and said he'd know better by and by. Upon which the old gentleman, observing Oliver's colour mounting, changed the subject by asking whether there had been much of a crowd at the execution that morning. This made him wonder more and more, for it was plain from the replies of the two boys that they had both been there, and Oliver naturally wondered how they could possibly have found time to be so very industrious. When the breakfast was cleared away, the merry old gentleman and the two boys played at a very curious and uncommon game, which was performed in this way. The merry old gentleman, placing a snuff-box in one pocket of his trousers, a note-case in the other, and a watch in his waistcoat pocket, with a guard chain round his neck, and sticking a mock diamond pin in his shirt, buttoned his coat tight round him, and putting his spectacle case and handkerchief in his pockets, trotted up and down the room with a stick, in imitation of the manner in which old gentlemen walk about the streets any hour in the day. Sometimes he stopped at the fireplace, and sometimes at the door, making believe that he was staring with all his might into shop windows. At such times he would look constantly round him for fear of thieves, and would keep slapping all his pockets in turn to see that he hadn't lost anything, in such a very funny and natural manner that Oliver laughed till the tears ran down his face. All this time the two boys followed him closely about, getting out of his sight so nimbly every time he turned round that it was impossible to follow their motions. At last, the Dodger trod upon his toes or ran upon his boot accidentally, while Charlie Bates stumbled up against him behind. and in that one moment they took from him, with the most extraordinary rapidity, snuff-box, note-case, watch-guard, chain, shirt-pin, pocket-handkerchief, even the spectacle case. If the old gentleman felt a hand in any one of his pockets, he cried out where it was, and then the game began all over again. When this game had been played a great many times, a couple of young ladies called to see the young gentleman, one of whom was named Bet and the other Nancy. They wore a good deal of hair, not very neatly turned up behind, and were rather untidy about the shoes and stockings. They were not exactly pretty, perhaps, but they had a great deal of colour in their faces, and looked quite stout and hearty. Being remarkably free and agreeable in their manners, Oliver thought them very nice girls indeed, as there is no doubt they were. These visitors stopped a long time. Spirits were produced in consequence of one of the young ladies complaining of a coldness in her inside, and the conversation took a very convivial and improving turn. At length, Charlie Bates expressed his opinion that it was time to pad the hoof. This, it occurred to Oliver, must be French for going out, for directly afterwards the Dodger and Charlie and the two young ladies went away together, having been kindly furnished by the amiable old Jew with money to spend.
"There, my dear," said Fagin. "That's a pleasant life, isn't it? They have gone out for the day."
"Have they done work, sir?" inquired Oliver.
"Yes," said the Jew. "That is, unless they should unexpectedly come across any when they are out, and they won't neglect it if they do, my dear, depend upon it. Make 'em your models, my dear. Make 'em your models."
Tapping the fire shovel on the hearth to add force to his words.
"Do everything they bid you, and take their advice in all matters, especially the Dodger's, my dear. He'll be a great man himself, and will make you one too, if you take pattern by him. Is my handkerchief hanging out of my pocket, my dear?"
said the Jew, stopping short.
"Yes, sir," said Oliver.
"See if you can take it out without my feeling it, as you saw them do when we were at play this morning."
Oliver held up the bottom of the pocket with one hand, as he had seen the Dodger hold it, and drew the handkerchief lightly out of it with the other.
"Is it gone?"
cried the Jew.
"Here it is, sir," said Oliver, showing it in his hand.
"You're a clever boy, my dear,"
said the playful old gentleman, patting Oliver on the head approvingly.
"I never saw a sharper lad. Here's a shilling for you. If you go on in this way, you'll be the greatest man of the time. And now come here, and I'll show you how to take the marks out of the handkerchiefs."
Oliver wondered what picking the old gentleman's pocket in play had to do with his chances of being a great man. But thinking that the Jew, being so much his senior, must know best, he followed him quietly to the table and was soon deeply involved in his new study. Chapter 10. Oliver becomes better acquainted with the characters of his new associates and purchases experience at a high price, being a short but very important chapter in this history. For many days, Oliver remained in the Jew's room, picking the marks out of the pocket handkerchiefs, of which a great number were brought home, and sometimes taking part in the game already described, which the two boys and the Jew played regularly every morning. At length he began to languish for fresh air, and took many occasions of earnestly entreating the old gentleman to allow him to go out to work with his two companions. Oliver was rendered the more anxious to be actively employed by what he had seen of the stern morality of the old gentleman's character. Whenever the Dodger or Charlie Bates came home at night empty-handed, he would expatiate with great vehemence on the misery of idle and lazy habits, and would enforce upon them the necessity of an active life by sending them supperless to bed. On one occasion, indeed, he even went so far as to knock them both down a flight of stairs, but this was carrying out his virtuous precepts to an unusual extent. At length, one morning, Oliver obtained the permission he had so eagerly sought. There had been no handkerchiefs to work upon for 2 or 3 days, and the dinners had been rather meagre. Perhaps these were the reasons for the old gentleman's giving his assent. But whether they were or no, he told Oliver he might go, and placed him under the joint guardianship of Charlie Bates and his friend the Dodger. The three boys sallied out, the Dodger with his coat sleeves tucked up and his hat cocked as usual, Master Bates sauntering along with his hands in his pockets, and Oliver between them, wondering where they were going and what branch of manufacture he would be instructed in first. The pace at which they went was such a very lazy, ill-looking saunter that Oliver soon began to think his companions were going to deceive the old gentleman by not going to work at all. The Dodger had a vicious propensity, too, of pulling the caps from the heads of small boys and tossing them down areas, while Charlie Bates exhibited some very loose notions concerning the rights of property by pilfering divers apples and onions from the stalls at the kennel sides and thrusting them into pockets which were so surprisingly capacious that they seemed to undermine his whole suit of clothes in every direction. These things looked so bad that Oliver was on the point of declaring his intention of seeking his way back in the best way he could, when his thoughts were suddenly directed into another channel by a very mysterious change of behaviour on the part of the Dodger. They were just emerging from a narrow court not far from the open square in Clerkenwell, which is yet called, by some strange perversion of terms, the Green, when the Dodger made a sudden stop, and laying his finger on his lip, drew his companions back again with the greatest caution and circumspection. "What's the matter?" demanded Oliver.
"Hush!" replied the Dodger. "Do you see that old cove at the bookstall?"
"The old gentleman over the way," said Oliver. "Yes, I see him."
"He'll do,"
said the Dodger.
"A prime plant," observed Master Charlie Bates.
Oliver looked from one to the other with the greatest surprise. But he was not permitted to make any inquiries, for the two boys walked stealthily across the road and slunk close behind the old gentleman towards whom his attention had been directed. Oliver walked a few paces after them, and not knowing whether to advance or retire, stood looking on in silent amazement. The old gentleman was a very respectable-looking personage, with a powdered head and gold spectacles. He was dressed in a bottle-green coat with a black velvet collar, wore white trousers, and carried a smart bamboo cane under his arm. He had taken up a book from the stall, and there he stood, reading away as hard as if he were in his elbow chair in his own study. It is very possible that he fancied himself there indeed, for it was plain from his abstraction that he saw not the bookstall, nor the street, nor the boys, nor, in short, anything but the book itself, which he was reading straight through, turning over the leaf when he got to the bottom of a page, beginning at the top line of the next one, and going regularly on with the greatest interest and eagerness. What was Oliver's horror and alarm as he stood a few paces off, looking on with his eyelids as wide open as they would possibly go, to see the Dodger plunge his hand into the old gentleman's pocket and draw from thence a handkerchief. To see him hand the same to Charlie Bates, and finally to behold them both running away round the corner at full speed. In an instant, the whole mystery of the handkerchiefs, and the watches, and the jewels, and the Jew rushed upon the boy's mind. He stood for a moment, with the blood so tingling through all his veins from terror that he felt as if he were in a burning fire. Then, confused and frightened, he took to his heels, and not knowing what he did, made off as fast as he could lay his feet to the ground. This was all done in a minute's space, and the very instant that Oliver began to run, the old gentleman, putting his hand to his pocket and missing his handkerchief, turned sharp round. Seeing the boy scudding away at such a rapid pace, he very naturally concluded him to be the depredator, and shouting, "Stop, thief!" with all his might, made off after him, book in hand. But the old gentleman was not the only person who raised the hue and cry. The Dodger and Master Bates, unwilling to attract public attention by running down the open street, had merely retired into the very first doorway round the corner. They no sooner heard the cry and saw Oliver running than, guessing exactly how the matter stood, they issued forth with great promptitude and, shouting, "Stop, thief!" too, joined in the pursuit like good citizens. Although Oliver had been brought up by philosophers, he was not theoretically acquainted with the beautiful axiom that self-preservation is the first law of nature. If he had been, perhaps he would have been prepared for this. Not being prepared, however, it alarmed him the more. So away he went like the wind, with the old gentleman and the two boys roaring and shouting behind him. Stop thief! Stop thief! There is a magic in the sound. The tradesman leaves his counter, and the carman his wagon. The butcher throws down his tray, the baker his basket, the milkman his pail, the errand boy his parcels, the schoolboy his marbles, the pavior his pickaxe, the child his battledore. Away they run, pell-mell, helter-skelter, slap-dash, tearing, yelling, screaming, knocking down the passengers as they turn the corners, rousing up the dogs, and astonishing the fowls. And streets, squares, and courts re-echo with the sound. Stop thief! Stop thief! The cry is taken up by 100 voices, and the crowd accumulate at every turning. Away they fly, splashing through the mud and rattling along the pavements. Up go the windows, out run the people, onward bear the mob. A whole audience desert Punch in the very thickest of the plot, and joining the rushing throng, swell the shout and lend fresh vigour to the cry, Stop thief! Stop thief! Stop thief! Stop thief! There is a passion for hunting something deeply implanted in the human breast. One wretched, breathless child, panting with exhaustion, terror in his looks, agony in his eyes, large drops of perspiration streaming down his face, strains every nerve to make head upon his pursuers. And as they follow on his track and gain upon him every instant, they hail his decreasing strength with still louder shouts and whoop and scream with joy. Stop thief! Aye, stop him, for God's sake, were it only in mercy. Stopped at last. A clever blow. He is down upon the pavement, and the crowd eagerly gather round him, each newcomer jostling and struggling with the others to catch a glimpse. Stand aside. Give him a little air. Nonsense, he don't deserve it. Where's the gentleman? Here he is, coming down the street. Make room there for the gentleman. Is this the boy, sir? Yes. Oliver lay, covered with mud and dust, and bleeding from the mouth, looking wildly round upon the heap of faces that surrounded him, when the old gentleman was officiously dragged and pushed into the circle by the foremost of the pursuers. "Yes," said the gentleman, "I am afraid it is the boy."
"Afraid," murmured the crowd, "that's a good un."
"Poor fellow," said the gentleman, "he has hurt himself."
"I did that, sir," said a great lubberly fellow, stepping forward, "and preciously I cut my knuckles agin his mouth. I stopped him, sir."
The fellow touched his hat with a grin, expecting something for his pains. But the old gentleman, eyeing him with an expression of dislike, looked anxiously round, as if he contemplated running away himself, which it is very possible he might have attempted to do, and thus have afforded another chase, had not a police officer, who is generally the last person to arrive in such cases, at that moment made his way through the crowd and seized Oliver by the collar.
"Come, get up," said the man roughly.
"It wasn't me, indeed, sir. Indeed, indeed, it was two other boys," said Oliver, clasping his hands passionately and looking round. "They are here somewhere."
"Oh, no, they ain't," said the officer.
He meant this to be ironical. But it was true, besides, for the Dodger and Charlie Bates had fled off down the first convenient court they came to.
"Come, get up."
"Don't hurt him," said the old gentleman compassionately.
"Oh, no, I won't hurt him," replied the officer, tearing his jacket half off his back, in proof thereof. "Come, I know you. It won't do. Will you stand up on your legs, you young devil?"
Oliver, who could hardly stand, made a shift to raise himself on his feet, and was at once lugged along the streets by the jacket collar at a rapid pace. The gentleman walked on with them by the officer's side, and as many of the crowd as could achieve the feat got a little ahead and stared back at Oliver from time to time. The boys shouted in triumph, and on they went. Chapter 11 treats of Mr. Fang, the police magistrate, and furnishes a slight specimen of his mode of administering justice. The offence had been committed within the district, and indeed in the immediate neighbourhood of a very notorious metropolitan police office. The crowd had only the satisfaction of accompanying Oliver through two or three streets and down a place called Mutton Hill, when he was led beneath a low archway and up a dirty court into this dispensary of summary justice by the back way. It was a small paved yard into which they turned, and here they encountered a stout man with a bunch of whiskers on his face and a bunch of keys in his hand.
"What's the matter now?" said the man, carelessly.
"A young fogle hunter," replied the man who had Oliver in charge.
"Are you the party that's been robbed, sir?" inquired the man with the keys.
"Yes, I am," replied the old gentleman. "But I am not sure that this boy actually took the handkerchief. I would rather not press the case."
"Must go before the magistrate now, sir," replied the man. "His worship will be disengaged in half a minute. Now, young gallows."
This was an invitation for Oliver to enter through a door which he unlocked as he spoke, and which led into a stone cell. Here he was searched, and nothing being found upon him, locked up. This cell was in shape and size something like an area cellar, only not so light. It was most intolerably dirty, for it was Monday morning, and it had been tenanted by six drunken people who had been locked up elsewhere since Saturday night. But this is little. In our station houses, men and women are every night confined on the most trivial charges. The word is worth noting. In dungeons, compared with which those in Newgate, occupied by the most atrocious felons, tried, found guilty, and under sentence of death, are palaces. Let anyone who doubts this compare the two. The old gentleman looked almost as rueful as Oliver when the key grated in the lock. He turned with a sigh to the book, which had been the innocent cause of all this disturbance.
"There is something in that boy's face," said the old gentleman to himself as he walked slowly away, tapping his chin with the cover of the book in a thoughtful manner. "Something that touches and interests me. Can he be innocent? He looked like... By the by," exclaimed the old gentleman, halting very abruptly and staring up into the sky. "God bless my soul! Where have I seen something like that look before?"
After musing for some minutes, the old gentleman walked with the same meditative face into a back anteroom opening from the yard, and there, retiring into a corner, called up before his mind's eye a vast amphitheatre of faces, over which a dusky curtain had hung for many years.
"No," said the old gentleman, shaking his head. "It must be imagination."
He wandered over them again. He had called them into view, and it was not easy to replace the shroud that had so long concealed them. There were faces of friends and foes, and of many that had been almost strangers peering intrusively from the crowd. There were the faces of young and blooming girls that were now old women. There were others that the grave had changed to ghastly trophies of death, but which the mind, superior to its power, still dressed in their old freshness and beauty, calling back the lustre of the eyes, the brightness of the smile, the beaming of the soul through its mask of clay, and whispering of beauty beyond the tomb, changed but to be heightened, and taken from earth only to be set up as a light, to shed a soft and gentle glow upon the path to heaven. But the old gentleman could recall no one countenance of which Oliver's features bore a trace. So he heaved a sigh over the recollections he had awakened, and being, happily for himself, an absent old gentleman, buried them again in the pages of the musty book. He was roused by a touch on the shoulder, and a request from the man with the keys to follow him into the office. He closed his book hastily, and was at once ushered into the imposing presence of the renowned Mr. Fang. The office was a front parlour with a panelled wall. Mr. Fang sat behind a bar at the upper end, and on one side the door was a sort of wooden pen in which poor little Oliver was already deposited, trembling very much at the awfulness of the scene. Mr. Fang was a lean, long-backed, stiff-necked, middle-sized man, with no great quantity of hair, and what he had growing on the back and sides of his head. His face was stern and much flushed. If he were really not in the habit of drinking rather more than was exactly good for him, he might have brought an action against his countenance for libel, and have recovered heavy damages. The old gentleman bowed respectfully, and advancing to the magistrate's desk, said, suiting the action to the word, "That is my name and address, sir." He then withdrew a pace or two, and with another polite and gentlemanly inclination of the head, waited to be questioned. Now it so happened that Mr. Fang was at that moment perusing a leading article in a newspaper of the morning, adverting to some recent decision of his, and commending him for the 350th time to the special and particular notice of the Secretary of State for the Home Department. He was out of temper, and he looked up with an angry scowl.
"Who are you?" said Mr. Fang.
The old gentleman pointed with some surprise to his card.
"Officer,"
said Mr. Fang, tossing the card contemptuously away with the newspaper.
"Who is this fellow?"
"My name, sir," said the old gentleman, speaking like a gentleman, "my name, sir, is Brownlow. Permit me to inquire the name of the magistrate who offers a gratuitous and unprovoked insult to a respectable person under the protection of the bench." Saying this, Mr. Brownlow looked round the office as if in search of some person who would afford him the required information.
"Officer," said Mr. Fang, throwing the paper on one side, "what's this fellow charged with?"
"He's not charged at all, your worship," replied the officer. "He appears against the boy, your worship."
His worship knew this perfectly well, but it was a good annoyance and a safe one.
"Appears against the boy, does he?"
said Fang, surveying Mr. Brownlow contemptuously from head to foot.
"Swear him."
"Before I am sworn, I must beg to say one word," said Mr. Brownlow, "and that is that I really never, without actual experience, could have believed—"
"Hold your tongue, sir,"
said Mr. Fang peremptorily.
"I will not, sir,"
replied the old gentleman.
"Hold your tongue this instant, or I'll have you turned out of the office," said Mr. Fang. "You're an insolent, impertinent fellow. How dare you bully a magistrate?"
"What?" exclaimed the old gentleman, reddening.
"Swear this person," said Fang to the clerk. "I'll not hear another word. Swear him."
Mr. Brownlow's indignation was greatly roused, but reflecting, perhaps, that he might only injure the boy by giving vent to it, he suppressed his feelings and submitted to be sworn at once.
"Now," said Fang, "what's the charge against this boy? What have you got to say, sir?"
"I was standing at a bookstall," Mr. Brownlow began.
"Hold your tongue, sir," said Mr. Fang. "Policeman? Where's the policeman? Here, swear this policeman. Now, policeman, what is this?"
The policeman, with becoming humility, related how he had taken the charge, how he had searched Oliver and found nothing on his person, and how that was all he knew about it.
"Are there any witnesses?" inquired Mr. Fang.
"None, your worship," replied the policeman.
Mr. Fang sat silent for some minutes, and then turning round to the prosecutor, said in a towering passion,
"Do you mean to state what your complaint against this boy is, man, or do you not? You have been sworn. Now, if you stand there refusing to give evidence, I'll punish you for disrespect to the bench. I will, by—"
By what, or by whom, nobody knows, for the clerk and jailer coughed very loud just at the right moment, and the former dropped a heavy book upon the floor, thus preventing the word from being heard, accidentally, of course. With many interruptions and repeated insults, Mr. Brownlow contrived to state his case, observing that in the surprise of the moment he had run after the boy because he saw him running away, and expressing his hope that if the magistrate should believe him, although not actually the thief, to be connected with thieves, he would deal as leniently with him as justice would allow.
"He has been hurt already," said the old gentleman in conclusion, "and I fear," he added with great energy, looking towards the bar, "I really fear that he is very ill."
"Oh, yes, I dare say," said Mr. Fang with a sneer. "Come, none of your tricks here, you young vagabond. They won't do. What's your name?"
Oliver tried to reply, but his tongue failed him. He was deadly pale, and the whole place seemed turning round and round.
"What's your name, you hardened scoundrel?"
thundered Mr. Fang.
"Officer, what's his name?"
This was addressed to a bluff old fellow in a striped waistcoat who was standing by the bar. He bent over Oliver and repeated the inquiry, But finding him really incapable of understanding the question, and knowing that his not replying would only infuriate the magistrate the more, and add to the severity of his sentence, he hazarded a guess.
"He says his name's Tom White, your worship," said this kind-hearted thief-taker.
"Oh, he won't speak out, won't he?" said Fang. "Very well, very well. Where does he live?"
"Where he can, your worship," replied the officer, again pretending to receive Oliver's answer.
"Has he any parents?"
inquired Mr. Fang.
"He says they died in his infancy, your worship," replied the officer, hazarding the usual reply.
At this point of the inquiry, Oliver raised his head, and looking round with imploring eyes, murmured a feeble prayer for a draught of water.
"Stuff and nonsense," said Mr. Fang. "Don't try to make a fool of me."
"I think he really is ill, your worship," remonstrated the officer.
"I know better," said Mr. Fang.
"Take care of him, officer," said the old gentleman, raising his hands instinctively. "He'll fall down."
"Stand away, officer," cried Fang savagely. "Let him if he likes."
Oliver availed himself of the kind permission and fell to the floor in a fainting fit. The men in the office looked at each other, but no one dared to stir.
"I knew he was shamming," said Fang,
as if this were incontestable proof of the fact.
"Let him lie there. He'll soon be tired of that."
"How do you propose to deal with the case, sir?" inquired the clerk in a low voice.
"Summarily," replied Mr. Fang. "He stands committed for 3 months. Hard labour, of course. Clear the office."
The door was opened for this purpose, and a couple of men were preparing to carry the insensible boy to his cell, when an elderly man of decent but poor appearance, clad in an old suit of black, rushed hastily into the office and advanced towards the bench.
"Stop! Stop! Don't take him away! For heaven's sake, stop a moment!"
cried the newcomer, breathless with haste. Although the presiding genii in such an office as this exercise a summary and arbitrary power over the liberties, the good name, the character, almost the lives of Her Majesty's subjects, especially of the poorer class, and although within such walls enough fantastic tricks are daily played to make the angels blind with weeping, they are closed to the public, save through the medium of the daily press. Mr. Fang was consequently not a little indignant to see an unbidden guest enter in such irreverent disorder.
"What is this? Who is this? Turn this man out! Clear the office!"
cried Mr. Fang.
"I will speak," cried the man. "I will not be turned out. I saw it all. I keep the bookstall. I demand to be sworn. I will not be put down. Mr. Fang, you must hear me. You must not refuse, sir."
The man was right. His manner was determined, and the matter was growing rather too serious to be hushed up.
"Swear the man,"
growled Mr. Fang with a very ill grace.
"Now, man, what have you got to say?"
"This," said the man. "I saw three boys, two others and the prisoner here, loitering on the opposite side of the way when this gentleman was reading. The robbery was committed by another boy. I saw it done, and I saw that this boy was perfectly amazed and stupefied by it."
Having by this time recovered a little breath, the worthy bookstall keeper proceeded to relate in a more coherent manner the exact circumstances of the robbery.
"Why didn't you come here before?"
said Fang, after a pause.
"I hadn't a soul to mind the shop," replied the man. "Everybody who could have helped me had joined in the pursuit. I could get nobody till 5 minutes ago, and I've run here all the way."
"The prosecutor was reading, was he?"
inquired Fang, after another pause.
"Yes," replied the man. "The very book he has in his hand."
"Oh, that book, eh?" said Fang. "Is it paid for?"
No, it is not," replied the man, with a smile.
"Dear me, I forgot all about it," exclaimed the absent old gentleman, innocently.
"A nice person to prefer a charge against a poor boy,"
said Fang, with a comical effort to look humane.
"I consider, sir, that you have obtained possession of that book under very suspicious and disreputable circumstances, and you may think yourself very fortunate that the owner of the property declines to prosecute. Let this be a lesson to you, my man, or the law will overtake you yet. The boy is discharged. Clear the office."
"Damn me!" cried the old gentleman, bursting out with the rage he had kept down so long. "Damn me! I'll
clear the office," said the magistrate. "Officers, do you hear? Clear the office!"
The mandate was obeyed, and the indignant Mr. Brownlow was conveyed out with the book in one hand and the bamboo cane in the other, in a perfect frenzy of rage and defiance. He reached the yard, and his passion vanished in a moment. Little Oliver Twist lay on his back on the pavement, with his shirt unbuttoned and his temples bathed with water, his face a deadly white, and a cold tremble convulsing his whole frame.
"Poor boy, poor boy," said Mr. Brownlow, bending over him. "Call a coach, somebody, pray, directly."
A coach was obtained, and Oliver, having been carefully laid on one seat, the old gentleman got in and sat himself on the other.
"May I accompany you?" said the bookstall keeper, looking in. "Bless me, yes, my dear sir," said Mr. Brownlow quickly. "I forgot you. Dear, dear, I have this unhappy book still. Jump in, poor fellow. There's no time to lose."